You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our SmartCast microlearning podcast series titled Transforming Care Through Next Generation Therapies in NAMD and DME to Lower Treatment Burden and Improve Outcomes, an expansion of the Vision Relief No Eyes Left Behind initiative. This series is hosted by Dr. David Eichenbaum, a collaborative associate professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of South Florida Morsani College of Medicine, and Director of Research, Retina Vitreous Associates of Florida in St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's get started with today's episode.
Hello and welcome. My name is Dr. David Eichenbaum, and I am the host of today's podcast, Transforming Care Through Next Generation Therapies in Neovascular Macular Degeneration and Diabetic Macular Edema to Lower Burden and Improve Outcomes. This is a four-part podcast talking about unmet needs in NAMD and DME treatment, addressing treatment burden. Today, I will be interviewing the incredible Dr. Priya Vakharia, who works here with me at Retina Vitreous Associates of Florida. She's a collaborative assistant professor at the University of South Florida Morsani College of Medicine. And in this episode, we will be discussing barriers to adherence in the treatment of NAMD and DME. Hi, Priya. How are you?
Hi, David. I'm great. It's good to see you again. I just saw you this morning, but it feels like a long time.
It does. Our days are long, varied, and full of exciting sight-saving treats. All right. Let's talk about different barriers to adherence in the management of NAMD and DME. There are several factors to this, including treatment burden, including factors related to the disease that are individual to the pathology we're treating, and factors related to the patient that are specific to that patient's clinical scenario. Let's start with treatment burden. Talk to me about what we've got and what the issues are with adherence for patients as they are receiving treatment.
So, it comes as no surprise that one of the biggest issues with the treatment of neovascular AMD and DME is getting the injections themselves. A lot of patients have, a heavy burden of injections. Initially, they have to come in every 4 weeks, and sometimes they have to stay at frequent intervals long-term, 4 to 6 weeks. And this can really build up because remember, these patients are not only seeing us as retina specialists, but they're seeing their nephrologist and their podiatrist and their cardiologist, and it starts to really become a huge burden coming to your office and waiting to see you and get an injection in their eye. Also, patients don't necessarily like getting injections. It's not a fun thing. It's not a pleasant experience to get a needle in their eye and then have SPK or dry eye after an injection. And so all of this leads to, this heavy burden of treatment for these patients. And while these injections are incredible and vision saving, this can be a lot for our patients.
So that's why a lot of them drop off, I think. I think it's fatiguing. And that's why I try to be encouraging to them when I see them. After someone's gotten their 70-second injection, you kind of run out of clinical things to talk about. I run out of clinical things to talk about long before that. So I try to come up with other things to encourage them and tell them how this treatment is helping them. How are their grandkids if they're an AMD patient? How's their job if they're a younger DME patient? I hope things are going well. We're doing this together. I try to be encouraging about the burden of treatment. Do you find any tricks to keep them sticking around and keep that vision up with the ongoing injections?
Absolutely. So one of the things I do, I actually learned from you, which is learning about each patient and asking about it, whether it's their family or having something to talk to them about, because then the patient feels like you remember them and they feel like more than just another injection patient in your clinic. The second thing is always every visit, making sure that they need that interval. Sometimes when we see patients, we're just so used to them getting injections every 6 weeks and we forget to try to extend them again. And I think every week or two means a lot for patients. And so, trying to push that envelope if possible, staying on top of current literature, answering their questions about new therapies that may be there. All of these things are important. So, reminding yourself that this patient really wants to extend those intervals and trying to do that if possible. And the last thing is always being positive. Sometimes our patients don't have great vision, and I feel that staying positive is important. It's important to be real, but it's important to stay positive about their disease so that they feel like they are achieving something by coming to your office.
I love those. Those are wonderful things that all of us can employ in our practice and probably employ more of. There's never enough of those extra encouragements to keep people adhering to their treatment. It's a great segue talking about new treatments and how they can affect disease to disease-related factors, because we do have patients with common retinal disease like NAMD who need a shot every 6 weeks. And we also have patients who need a shot every 10 weeks or 12 weeks or 16 weeks. When a patient is stuck at a frequent interval, I find that becomes a problem for adherence because they're discouraged in a large part. They feel like they're failing me, I think, or failing the treatment when they come in and they have recurrent subretinal fluid and AMD, or they're getting boggier and DME, and it hasn't been all that long. And of course, they all talk in the waiting room and they say, well, Mr. Jones doesn't have to come back for 10 weeks or 12 weeks. You know, why am I coming back at 4 or 5 weeks?
Huge, David. And they all, you said it correctly, they all share their stories. My patients, you know, I work here in Palm Harbor and my patients all go to the same gym and they go to the same rec center and they compare intervals and they'll come in and talk to me about it. And they'll say, hey, Mary gets injections every 12 weeks. Why am I stuck at 5 weeks? And I think this is really important to try to get those patients as long as possible. And we're lucky that we have great therapies that are allowing us to do that.
Mm-hmm. Newer therapies. It's also the burden on the people who care for the patient, you know, especially our older patients in AMD who have caregivers that bring them. Our younger patients with DME often have to take time out of caring for their children or parents, or time out of their job to come in. The getting to the frequent injections has a social burden and an economic burden on the patients, which is separate than the disease burden or the unpleasantness of actually receiving the injection. Family is often in the room when the patients come in, especially for me with the NAMD patients, and I like to turn around and address them. What do you like to tell the family when they're in the room and you know they don't want to be there? They'd rather be at work instead of taking their parent to the retina specialist, or they'd rather be doing a number of other things, or just seeing their parent for lunch, perhaps, if they truly love their parent, like many of them do, rather than hanging out in our office. So I like to turn around and address them. What do you say to the families to keep them coming, whether it's NAMD or DME?
I remind them that their family member is doing great, that their vision is improving, and that these treatments are helping them maintain some sense of independence. Even if they may not be able to drive, these injections are helping them cook and read and pay their bills, perhaps, you know, depending on the severity of their disease. And so I remind them of the importance. And then I also just kind of ask how it's going. You know, is the family having to take a lot of time off of work? A lot of times Medicare or certain Medicare Advantage plans will help with transportation for patients. And so there are other factors that can sometimes be worked out if this is becoming really challenging, because again, we want to help our patients have compliance with therapy as best as possible.
All of that is true, and I agree. And I think that taking the time to speak to the family and get them plugged in is time well spent. You know, anything that engages the patient and their ecosystem to get them to come in more frequently is good. And why is all of this good? Well, with legacy therapies, with the treatments we've used since 2005 with off-label bevacizumab, and then since 2006 with ranibizumab, and 2011 with aflibercept 2 mg, there's been a well-established association between receiving the injections often and preserving vision. It's a correlation. It doesn't mean that that's the only thing that's keeping patients seeing well, or the lack of injections and adherence is the only thing that's causing them to lose vision, but it's a strong correlation, and lots of large data sets that have been published and peer-reviewed that frequent injections with our legacy agents, at least, are associated with preservation of vision. Do you agree with that, at least with what we've been doing for the last 15 to 20 years?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, these injections are incredible at preserving vision. And I think there's a lot of data showing that in the real world, we aren't achieving the same results as in trials, possibly because of undertreatment. And again, this is multifactorial and could be you know, there's so many factors that go into that, but important to try to get patients in for those injections to give them the best vision possible.
We know the literature. We agree you need lots of shots to do well. At least you have needed a lot of shots to do well. It's hard because the treatments are burdensome. It's hard because the disease can be very active. It's hard because not only does the patient have to get there, but the caregivers often have to get there. So I know that our practice speaks amongst ourselves quite a bit about trying to make this easier. What do you do? What do you think we've done well as a practice and you've done well as a physician in the practice to make the injections more tolerable, to address these barriers and limit them?
I think one of the things that I have been blown away with in this practice since joining is the push to really make comfortable injections. And this cannot be understated. If a patient walks away from the office in a lot of pain after their injection, why would they come back? You know, at some point they're going to say, it's just not worth it. I just won't read anymore. And so really dedicating time to coming up with a painless injection protocol is important. And that can be multiple things. That can just be a lidocaine pledget, something that you soak in the eye. And that's something we oftentimes do here in our practice. That could be using subconjunctival lidocaine. That could be using, you know, a brand name drop, something for anesthesia during your injections. Or that could be the antiseptic. Perhaps your patient is betadine sensitive, and perhaps you should pivot away towards chlorhexidine, which has been shown to have much more tolerability and equivocal safety. And so I think really taking the time to ask your patients how the injection was is important. And if a patient calls after hours, I mark that in my chart because I want them to know that I remember. You know, when they come in the next time, I probably will have forgotten unless there's a note in my chart, but I'll say, hey, I remember that you had a lot of issue with your last injection. Let's work on making it better. And I think that is incredibly important.
And I think those are incredible strategies, and I'm glad that I've had the chance to work on those with you. And your input's been tremendous in making this a better way to give patients injections. It kind of goes back to talking to the patients about something personally individual to them. It makes them truly believe that you're listening to them. If you even voice that you can individualize the anesthesia. And I often tell them, we have choices, we have options. So you don't really have options to get the shots if you want to keep reading and driving and having the good visual function, but I've got options to how I can numb you up. And then we talk about, you know, as you mentioned in our practice, we routinely do pledgets. We can still do subcont anesthesia. There are brand name drops that are newly available that are very good topical anesthetics, much better than the old proparacaine and tetracaine drops. We can use 4% lidocaine, so Q-tips. But I talk to the patients about it, and then I make a note in the chart, like you were saying, to ask them how things are going. And post-injection, I think a lot of the pain is after the injection, maybe even more so than during the injection. So I like giving patients topical anti-inflammatories after the injections. It can be a non-steroidal or steroidal anti-inflammatory, and I caution them to use it for just a short amount of time. And if they have increasing pain after they have a topical anti-inflammatory, let's say 2 days after the injection, they've got to call us. I tell them it should be painless within 24 hours with this drop if you've had trouble before. Of course, we use copious preservative-free artificial tears. We have handouts for them. Making the patient feel like you're individualizing is huge. Do you ever use topical anti-inflammatories post-injection? And if so, what's your drop of choice?
I do. Again, this is something that I learned from you and from others in our practice. If I have a patient who's very sensitive after the injections, I will prescribe a low-dose steroid. And sometimes I'll put ointment in their eye right after the injection and patch the eye just to kind of keep things calm and quiet. But I'll use a low-dose steroid, a topical anti-inflammatory like lodipretinol. Work with them to figure out a method that works for them.
And all of this kind of drills down to a kind of soft science issue, which are the psychosocial needs of the patient when patients are getting treatment. I think this is a bigger role in the overall treatment of common retinal disease than at least I think about every day on a regular basis. What's your approach to maintaining a patient's psychosocial status, or at least assessing it or addressing it. Obviously, we're not going to be their psychiatrists or their psychologists, but regarding the psychology of intravitreal injections, I think it's good to think about that some.
I think this is something that we don't do well enough. And I've been trying. You know, I think the first thing is, I'll give an anecdote. I have a patient who's monocular and gets injections every 4 weeks. And the last time he was here, I asked him how he was doing. And he said, good. And I said, but how are you doing? Are you depressed? And he said, absolutely. I'm very depressed. And his wife nodded her head. And I didn't realize that there was this whole aspect of anxiety and depression. And I just took a minute to acknowledge it. And you're right. I can't help with it. But I think he felt at least empowered that we talked about it a little bit. I have a very low threshold to plug patients into low vision. I have a very low threshold to tell them to seek any help if they need it for anxiety, depression, et cetera, because this is a real thing that our patients have, especially if they have low vision associated with their injections, and especially our younger diabetic patients who maybe aren't doing well and can't work and can't, you know, help their family. I think this is an important aspect to talk about.
Yeah, I agree with you. In the lane, I think that act of just asking how you're feeling and acknowledging the feelings goes a long way. I think at some point, somebody telling me how to have better relationships told me to acknowledge feelings. So I try to translate that to the patients and tell the patients that I hear you, you know, I at least hear you're sad. And I know there's literature discussing how vision loss is associated with a high incidence of depression, even monocular vision loss, which is interesting, as the practical side of me says, well, your other eye is seeing well, why are you so sad? But there is evidence that's peer reviewed that shows monocular vision loss is correlated with patients having a higher incidence of depression. So I think it's reasonable to address it and at least acknowledge their feelings and direct them towards care if it becomes an issue. I have said, and I don't get into this amount of depth often, I do tell patients, you know, you seem like you're really sad. Would you like me to get you in with your primary care doctor to talk about that? And then I don't make referrals to psychology or psychiatry. I leave that to primary care, but I will facilitate the patient getting back to primary care. If it's not quite that bad and they feel sad, I tell them that there's a lot of social media groups out there dedicated to patients with macular degeneration. Like you said, the low vision clinics around us are wonderful, and they have community resources they can give the patients. A lot of our patients live in facilities, and their groups that meet in the facilities, the older patients with neovascular AMD, and they have low vision groups or macular degeneration support groups, and I tell them to seek those out. And a lot of my patients do really like that there's a community out there with people who are suffering like they are.
Absolutely. There was a recent paper, more on the dry AMD standpoint, that showed that patients would exchange 67% of their life expectancy in order to regain vision. And their retina physician underestimated it by 97%. You know, retina specialists just had no idea. So I completely agree with you, David. It's important that we remind ourselves of how important patients' vision is. And any tools that are available, I think, are helpful.
Thank you very much, Priya, for being here with us today. I always enjoy speaking with you. I'm fortunate that you're part of our group. You're an incredible rising star in retina, and it's a privilege to have these conversations with you on a regular basis, not just on a podcast. It's important to be able to understand the barriers that patients face in the management of their conditions and offer them options to improve their outcomes. I look forward to delving deeper into how advances in next-generation anti-VEGF therapy can help to address treatment barriers in our next episode with our friend Dr. Vas Sada. We appreciate the time you took to discuss these issues with us today, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you for listening. Please join us again soon for another episode in this series discussing strategies to reduce the treatment burden and improve outcomes for NAMD and DME. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide CME for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And a special thank you to our grant supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, who provided an independent medical education grant for this activity.